example of a godly man that we have in the whole Old Testament. He had tremendous gifts and talents and abilities. Among them, early on in his life, he was a shepherd. The family had sheep, and he took care of the family sheep. And while he was taking care of the sheep, he developed some really important skills. It wasn't just a matter of sitting there watching the sheep graze. He worked with his slingshot and developed a great accuracy with his slingshot. He could hit the proverbial telephone pole at 40 paces. It was just something he learned how to do. He developed his ability to defend his sheep. The sheep were important to him. It was important to the whole family. And so in order to make sure that wild animals didn't take the sheep, he was always vigilant, probably with his slingshot. But he also was able to defend the sheep. He tells one point, he said, I was able to kill a bear. And I was at another point, I was able to kill a lion in defense of the sheep. So he found out that there are things worth defending, and he set about to defend those things that needed to be defended. Then he developed his skill, I think, out there in the pasture land as a poet and as a musician. He wrote poetry. We call them psalms, many of them. We read one this morning. He wrote this kind of thing, and as time went on, many of these were used in the worship of the people. So he was a songwriter, and he played an instrument that they called a harp. I don't think we should think of it as the harp we know, but they called it a harp, and he played it. He played it well enough, apparently, to play professionally. He played in front of the king, so he must have played pretty well. Then he was able, secondly, to parlay all of that skill that he learned as a shepherd into his ability to do warfare. He'd learned how to strategize and to really gain a foothold among the enemy. And so he used his slingshot early on to actually take down Goliath. Goliath was disdaining of David, who came to him with a slingshot. Goliath had a full armor, a sword, a shield, a bearer of his big shield to protect him. And David said, I come to you in the name of the Lord. He came boldly and stepped right up and gave Goliath something really to think about. And so it was a great victory for Israel. Following this strategic battle with the Philistines, David continued to become a great warrior and somebody who could lead the children of Israel. For 300 plus years, they'd been trying to defeat this group called the Philistines. And David, for the first time, actually conquered them and neutralized this group of people called the Philistines. It appears that he never lost a war. He was always on the winning side. Still as a young man, the prophet Samuel came to his father's house and said that God had instructed him to anoint the new king. There was a king, his name was King Saul, but King Saul was out of favor with God, disobeying God, and so God said, I'm going to anoint a new king, and David was anointed at that time. But thereafter, he was greatly tested. He had this sense of trust and confidence in God, but that was greatly tested. It's one thing to say you have great confidence in God, but God often sees to it that we have the kind of tests necessary for us to prove that we really do. And so what happens to David is, as soon as Saul realizes that people are fond of him and he is so successful, Saul begins to feel the threat of David, and so he chases him with his army all around the countryside, and David and his men become fugitives, and he has to really figure out what it is to trust in God and to believe in him at all points. At two points, David and his men outmaneuvered Saul and their men, and David could have killed King Saul. But he demonstrated a marvelous restraint by patiently waiting for God's time. He believed that God was giving him the kingship, but he was willing to wait for the time when it would come. Eventually, he does become king. And without question, he's the greatest king Israel ever had. If you said in the ancient world in Israel, the king, everybody knew who you were talking about. You were talking about David, because he was the king par excellence of their whole time. He was able to extend the borders of Israel. He was able to maintain those borders so that the size of Israel actually was larger under David than it had ever been, and probably ever has been since that time. All the surrounding countries around him that he didn't conquer,
became very submissive to him. Oftentimes he became like a statesman among them, and he had a geopolitical influence in the whole territory. In fact, people not wanting to be attacked by David would often send him special gifts from foreign countries in order to maintain a good relationship with David. So it was a great time. Probably the greatest thing that David did for his people, though, was he really restored a pattern of worship. The sanctuary where sacrificial offerings were made became central, and David led the people in worship with instruments and song, and this was a great highlight for David to have led his people this way. The New Testament has two summary phrases that it gives to David, it says about David. First of all, in Acts 13, it says that David was a man after God's own heart. What an accolade to receive, a man after God's own heart. And then secondly, he served his generation well. These are two great attributes to have said about one's life. What's not to like about this man? I mean, he's successful, skillful. It would be wonderful if we could kind of end the story right here with, and they all lived happily ever after. But there is still the rest of the story. Most of us know, if we've been around the Bible and church for very long, we know that David as king, at least on one complex of situations, abused his power. It's one thing to have power. It's another thing to be a person who uses power well. Having power is so tempting. It's so tempting to use power inappropriately. And at this one particular period, after a long history of using his power well, by and large, during this one particular complex of events, he abused his power. And we all know that that involved him committing adultery with another man's wife, and then in an attempt to cover up the consequences of that, of him having that man killed. So this great man that we admire and has this great reputation has this great flaw as well. We ask, how could this have happened? How could a man with such a long history of serving and worshiping God do such a thing? How could such a dreadful event occur while David was living out his dream of serving God? Now, at the time when this event happened, the army of Israel was off in fighting with the Ammonites. This would be current-day Jordan, basically. They were fighting to the east of them. And uncharacteristically, David wasn't with the troops. He was always the strategist, leading everything. But for some reason, Scripture doesn't tell us why, this time he was home, alone. And one evening, while the military was off fighting against the Ammonites, David was strolling on his palace roof when out of the corner of his eye, he happened to catch a glimpse of a woman some distance away who was bathing. He didn't know her, didn't know who she was, so he sent a messenger to inquire, who lives in this house anyway? And he finds out that her name is Bathsheba, and her husband, his name is Uriah, and unfortunately, Uriah's not home at the time. He's off with the military fighting against the Ammonites. Well, David knows he's not coming home very soon. So he sends another messenger to get Bathsheba to come to visit him in the palace. Now, most of us see danger written all over this, don't we? We want to shout, David, you're about to blow up your reputation. What's going on here? But unfortunately, you know, you can't stop the text. It just keeps going, and it keeps telling us about what happened. My father used to love to tell us boys, there were three besides me, we used to love to tell us the story about the horse and buggy days. He could still remember horse and buggy stuff, and so he loved to tell us stories about that. And he said that in those days, there was a man who owned a stagecoach company. They ferried people around to various places, and he needed a new driver. He was expanding his operations, and he needed another driver. And so he put out an advertisement and got three applicants to apply for the job of becoming a driver of a stagecoach. And so he had each of these applicants come in one at a time, and separately, and he asked them all the same question. What if you had your carriage with a woman and her three children in it, and you were driving along at full gallop, and in the distance you could see that there was a precipice, a cliff, a drop-off? How close do you think you could come to that, you know, riding parallel to it? How close could you come to that cliff without being afraid of endangering the people in your cabin, in your coach? The first guy said, well, parallel to that cliff, I believe I could be within 6 feet and feel confident. The second guy said, oh, no, no. I said, I could feel very comfortable within 3 feet of that cliff. That wouldn't bother me. And the third guy said, I'd stay as far away from that cliff as I could. He got the job. Anytime we think we can play with sin, get close to it, and you know, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, that kind of thing, the dipsy doodle, anytime we get to feeling like we can pull that off, we're already in trouble. David should have seen, I am asking for trouble here. I am begging for it, actually. I mean, I'm inviting it into my life, but he did anyway. So we have David doing what we would have never expected him to do. Again, as an illustration, back in the late 1980s, which is recent history to me. I mean, for some of you, it's like, I wasn't even born yet. But it was in the late 1980s, there was a young German man who was 19 years of age who rented a small single-engine plane in Finland, and he flew that plane from Helsinki across the Soviet border, the Soviet Union then, it's currently would call that territory to be Russia, but he flew across the Soviet border and was undetected by any of the massive radar system that the Soviets had. So he just continued flying until he got all the way to Moscow, never being detected. Now, had somebody flown a B-52 across that border like that, they would have been spotted in an instant, and the Soviets would have scrambled some fighter jets up there, and they would have taken that B-52 down. But this young man got all the way to Moscow. And in order to kind of prove his point that your system is vulnerable, he buzzed the Kremlin, you know, flew over it a couple times, buzzed it, and then he landed in Red Square. Now, he was obviously arrested, and the story went on and on for him. But he had made a significant but unwelcome point, and that is that their system was vulnerable. It was possible to fly under the radar and never be detected. And there it is. Some things fly under our radar. Goliath was a man of extensive war experience, as I mentioned. He knew how to kill people. So when David faced him, he knew what he was up against, a threat to all of Israel. But David believed that God had called him to defend Israel, like he had defended his sheep. And he took his slingshot and with one stone put down Goliath. Now, it's a later period of time. And David happens to be on the palace roof while his troops are fighting the Ammonites. And he happens to spot a half-clad woman, and his spiritual, emotional knees buckle. He falls for it, and not even realizing that he is actually inviting massive trouble into his life. She had no sword, no shield, no armor, just half clad, and it took him down. This is the man who wrote, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He restoreth my soul." I'm convinced that many of us, and it's probably autobiographical, but I'm convinced that many of us are as well-mannered as we are because we don't have opportunity to be otherwise. You know, we're not in a position to do otherwise. When David was a small boy taking care of the sheep in the pasture, the temptations were probably few. I mean, what could he do? But now he's king over Israel, and his position allows him to do what he could never have done before. And he's able to seek and inquire about this woman, to take her and to bring her to his bedroom. This is something you see, it's an abuse of power. Because he could, he did. And he took her into his bedroom and there abused her further. Now, before we get too judgmental of David, I know I'm sounding judgmental already. Before we get too judgmental, it's well for us to admit, I think, that we've all had an enemy come under our radar. For you men, and this whole story is going to impact men most, I suspect. For us, if somebody offered, if we were on a business trip or on some kind of a travel, and somebody came up to us and offered us a call girl, we would spot that in a second and say, "No way, not me. I'm a married man or whatever. I'm not doing that." But we don't think a bit about it when we're sitting in our family room watching TV of the missile that's coming right through the wires of our TV and into our eyes. Not even thinking about it. See, that's when you're not thinking about the threat. That's when the threat can come. When you're least expecting it, that's when you should expect it. That's the old saying. So we shouldn't get too judgmental in that. If you're like me, you can look back on some things in your life and say, "I can't believe I did that. That isn't who I am. That isn't who I want to be. That isn't my core values. None of that is true, but somehow I did it." Actually, the Apostle Paul has an interesting line in Romans chapter 7 where he talks about, he says, I'm amazed at myself. He said, "I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do." And he goes on to say, I basically have to say, that's not me. I mean, I so reject what that person does that I don't even call him me. Well, now, I think at the end of the day, we all have to own what we've done. And the apostle had to as well. David had to admit it. Undeniably, the prophet of God, Nathan, comes to him and says, "You are the man who has stolen another man's sheep and killed it." And David, of course, is able to pronounce judgment upon that man. But Nathan says, "You're the guy who did it, and here's what you did." And David finally says, "You're right." Psalm 32, which we read this morning, and Psalm 51 are evidences that David, after David's confession, God did forgive him. In fact, Nathan tells him right in the text of 2 Samuel, he says, "God has forgiven you." By all rights, David should have forfeited his life. But based on his willingness to confess, he was forgiven. And of course, that's a great encouragement to not only David, but to all of us who have made bad choices as well. But from this story forward, we recognize that nothing is going to quite be the same after this point. The impact of sins is not something we can control. You can't corral it. You can't corner it somehow. It is just out there. It gets a life of its own, so to speak. And so once done, the sin could be forgiven by God, but the impact of that sin continues to boomerang and ricochet all around David's life from that point forward. It's something to take very seriously. We sometimes think, well, yeah, some of the things I do, I don't really think are right, but it only affects me. I'm only one who's affected. And David would have to say, after his experience, not so. Sin is communal in many ways, and it will impact those around you for what you have done. So we have to remember that the impact of his sin, although the sin itself was forgivable, the impact went on and on and on. I'm prepared to say this about David. I have great admiration for him. Love the Psalms. Love many of the things that he did. He was a great defender of the honor of God. But I have to say this. I'm prepared to say it. I think he was a prince of a man in public, and pretty poor as a father. He really didn't have an ability to interact with his children in an effective way. In fact, he was sort of an uninvolved wimp at home. Is that how to communicate? Kind of a wimp at home. He has children. Now, here's part of the issue, probably. He has children by 7 different wives, and they don't always get along with each other. Amnon, who we know just because of this little piece of the story, appears to have been the oldest. There was an older one, never mentioned again. We think that he must have died in childhood. So Amnon's the oldest, and therefore he was the crown prince. He was the one you would expect to become king next after David, heir to the throne. The next oldest son is a fellow by the name of Absalom. And Absalom is from a different mother than Amnon, so they're half-brothers. And Absalom has a full sister, however. Her name is Tamar. And the scripture makes it clear to us that she was beautiful, just beyond gorgeous. So these three, Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom, are going to form a kind of a triangle of relationships that will result in a lot of bad blood in more ways than one. First, Amnon finds his half-sister Tamar just captivating. He's seen her at a distance. He loves what he sees. And guys can do that. I have been with young men we've been walking down the street, and they see a young woman, and they say, "I love her." So, do you know her? No, but I love her already. And this is kind of what it was with Amnon. He said, "I've seen her. I know I love her already." It's foregone conclusion. And so he has this great desire for his sister. He would love to be able to have a relationship with her. He'd love to be able to spend time with her. But it seems like he's excluded from that. Probably the mores of the day, because she was a virgin, would not allow her to have contact like this. Her mother, her other siblings would have protected her from this kind of thing. So it's going to take some intrigue on Amnon's part to figure out a way to break through the normal restrictions. So he goes to his father David, and he says, he actually does this through a series of people, but he says, "I have been very ill, I've been sick, and I think that I would be greatly encouraged if my half-sister Tamar could come into my room and cook some food for me and serve it to me. I think that would be such an encouragement, I would be well." Now, if you believe this story, you might as well start buying, real estate on Mars or something, because who is going to believe this story? You're going to be well if your half-sister comes in and cooks food for you and serves it to you. But David buys it. And he allows the conditions to exist that allow her to come into Amnon's room. When she gets in there, Amnon propositions her. She says no. And then he forces her. He rapes her. Not only does he rape her, but then he throws her out of the room and says, "Get out of here," and makes it appear like I didn't do anything wrong. Just normal king's son's activity, after all, because I can. So he shamed her, very much shamed in that culture in that time. Likely he spoiled her in regard to any potential future marriage. The text says she lived thereafter as a desolate woman. This to Absalom was absolutely unacceptable. Absalom was just deeply hurt by Amnon's actions. Not only had she raped his sister, but then he made it look like it's your problem, not mine. I don't know whether Amnon thought that, maybe Tamar would be as crazy about him as he was about her if she could just see him up close. I don't know if he thought, why doesn't she just agree to have a consensual relationship? What's wrong with that? I don't know what he was thinking. But he somehow gave the impression that he didn't need to be responsible for this whole thing. It was not really his problem. Absalom, surprisingly, played it rather cool. He doesn't raise a great big stink in the family about what's happened, but he is furious. He does want to find revenge, but he doesn't want to do anything that will give people a prior indication that he's going to do something. He wants it to be a complete surprise. So he keeps quiet. He doesn't say anything to Amnon. He doesn't speak about it to his father. He just leaves the matter where it is. But there's probably another reason why he's patient. He's expecting his dad, who is the chief judicial officer of the country, as king, he does expect his father to take action, that it's David's time to address this situation and to bring about justice. Well, once David does hear about the rape, he too is furious, but he does nothing. Since Amnon was the king's son, there was no one beyond the king who could actually bring justice to the situation. So with each passing day, while his father did nothing, Absalom nourishes his anger, and both Amnon and his father, both of them are on the receiving end. After 2 years of waiting, Absalom decides, if dad's not going to do something, then it's up to me. I will find revenge for what was done to my sister. So Absalom begins to scheme, plot. He wants to get even with Amnon, but you know, there could be a double benefit here. Not only getting even, but if he were to eliminate Amnon, he would now be the crown prince. He would now be the next in line. So he feels like this is a wonderful plan that I could do. I'll eliminate him. I'll become the new crown prince. And he thinks, well, how will I pull this off? Well, he says, I know my dad was so gullible when Amnon told him that he wanted his sister to come and feed him. I'll just try that myself. And so he says, Dad, I'm going to be at a particular place some distance from the palace, and I'd like my brothers to come along and enjoy the time. And his father said, well, why? You know, well, at least let Amnon come along. And his father says, okay. Now, he had to know there was some bad blood between these two boys. But he approved letting Amnon go to this place far away from the palace. And when they were there, Absalom has him ambushed and killed. David grieves deeply for Amnon. He had been the oldest son, the crown prince. But again, he seems paralyzed, unable to bring about justice. But how should he bring about justice anyway? The individual who did the killing was his son. Was he going to kill his son to bring about justice? It was a difficult spot to be in. So he struggled and just waited because he didn't know what to do. Absalom decides, because of safety reasons, that maybe he should leave. He thought, well, this could turn into a bloodbath. Somebody else could try to knock me off because I've done this. I've killed Amnon. So he decides that he will leave, and he goes up to the far country where he visits with his grandfather in Geshur, probably 80 miles away from Jerusalem. And now the waiting game really begins. Who's going to make the first move? Is it going to be Absalom? Is it going to be David? Apparently, Absalom thought, it is really my father's responsibility to make a move toward me. After all, he's the one who did not discipline Amnon in the beginning, left it all up to me to bring about justice. Therefore, he should make the first move to me. In fact, Absalom may have thought, if dad had done his job, Amnon could still be alive. But he didn't. So I had the responsibility. The biblical narrative tells us that David had deep longings for Absalom. He felt the loss of Absalom deeply, but he either won't or can't make a move toward Absalom. Perhaps having Absalom out of Jerusalem just made it easier, didn't have to deal with the whole problem. But for whatever reason, he didn't make any moves. Now, I do want to note the parallel between this father, David, and the father in Luke 15. When his prodigal went away, the father longed for his boy, looked for his boy, and had an open door to welcome him home. In David's case, he longs for the boy but doesn't know how to deal with it. His own bad history is so complicated in his mind, he doesn't now know how to bring justice or to invite someone else into his life. And so the boy stays away. For 3 years, he stays up in Geshur. Finally, Joab, feeling like this is not a good way for the kingdom to be run. I mean, the crown prince should be in Jerusalem, should be working with his father. So Joab, the general, decides he'll try to find ways to bring David, to bring Absalom home to Jerusalem, which he eventually gets David to agree to. But even though Absalom comes into Jerusalem, David says, you must live in your own house, and I don't ever want you to see my face. And so they don't meet for another 2 years. So now we're up to 5 years that the king has not seen his son. He has passion for him. He has love for him. He has concern for him. But there's this huge boulder in front of him, his own past. He's lost all of his moral authority and ability to deal with these kinds of situations because of the boulder that stands in his past. Now, I say David should have made the first move. He's the father. He's the one in power. He should have made the first move. He should have gone to his son Absalom and he should have said, Absalom, I'm so sorry that I didn't deal with the situation with Tamar. I know how much that hurt you. I don't believe what you did was right, but I can see the reasons for it. And I want to just tell you, I know what it is to be forgiven myself. I have this horrible thing in my past, and God forgave me. He'll forgive you as well. Just confess what you've done. Maybe David is actually waiting for Absalom to do that. Maybe he's waiting. He feels like there's no reconciliation possible as long as there's no real confession. Who's going to move first? Is it going to be David or is it going to be Absalom? My guess is that David has just been a pretty uninvolved father in terms of his ability to address situations in his own family. Even prior to the time of Bathsheba, he's busy leading a country, dealing with legal issues among the citizenry. He's dealing with border skirmishes. He's fighting wars. What time does he have for his family? And so his maximum energy goes into the public sphere, and what was left over goes to his family, and there wasn't really much left over. What would it have been like if David had have gone to his whole family right after Nathan confronted David with his sin and David received forgiveness of God? What if he had gone to his whole family and said, I just need to come clean with you. I have done what I would not recommend any of you doing. And I want to counsel you never to get yourself in a position where something can come under your radar and buckle your knees and take you over. So let me just tell you, this is what I really did. And this is what I'm asking you by the grace of God not to do. And if he would have listened to them and their hopes and dreams and fears and disappointments, if he would have talked to them and had a reciprocal relationship with them, maybe this would never have happened. It's an interesting study. I don't even know the exact data of it. But girls who have a great relationship with their father are much less likely to be promiscuous than those who do not. So if you do not have a good relationship with your father, a Pandora's box gets opened. And if this father had been relating to his children in a reciprocal way, things could have been very different. As it was, Amnon was able to wreck Tamar's life, without any consequences. Absalom observes this and feels like this is absolutely unacceptable. My father is able to dispense justice to everyone outside of the palace, but within our palace home, can't do a thing. So Joab, realizing the untenable situation that everyone was in, does bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. And still at this point, Absalom does not see his father for another 2 years. And during this time, he manages to build his anger even more than it had been built before. He decides finally after these 5 years, there's got to be something to bring about a resolution to the impasse. So through Joab again, he works to get an audience with his father. You know, he has to make arrangements to see his father. And so David finally says, okay, I'll see him. 5 years has passed. He says, I'll see him. So Absalom goes to David and he bows in front of him and David kisses him. It's got all the marks of reconciliation. The public is able to view it as reconciliation, but nothing has changed. Absalom hates his father as much as he did when he walked in, and David is as fearful of Absalom as he was when he walked in. So there's just a hostile relationship going on. But this does allow Absalom to get a new lease on life, as it were. He now is at home, everyone thinks he's once again in good favor with his father, the king. He now can be out in public, and so he's going to have a new lease on life. He's going to pursue a new goal that he has. And the new goal is that he's going to find a way to eliminate his father and become king himself. Now, here's how he does it. We find out in the text at this point that there are a couple things about Absalom that were to his benefit. One, he was just very handsome. It's a problem I've never had to deal with, but he was very handsome. In fact, if there would have been a Mr. Israel contest, winner, hands down. And not only was he very handsome and, you know, somebody that everyone would really notice, striking, but the way he carried himself and all was the same. He had a huge lock of hair, you know, very full and rich hair. Pro fans, think of Troy Polamalu. This is the kind of hair we're dealing with here. So this was an attribute. Now, you know what? Those people who are good-looking, handsome, beautiful, get treated differently than the rest of us. They get benefits and favors that others don't get. Now, in Tamar's case, it really didn't benefit her too much to be so beautiful. Look what happened to her. And that is not terribly uncharacteristic of what happens to a lot of beautiful women. In Absalom's case, he used his handsomeness, his good looks, to his benefit. And here's what he would do. He would, now that he's got able to move around in public, he got himself some horses and chariots and 50 guys who would attend to him as he moved from one place to another. And then he would stand in the city gate and he would say to people who were coming to the city to get legal renderings for problems they were having in their district, he'd say, you know what, you're probably not even going to get to see the king. But if I were a king, here's what I would do. And he would greet them, love them, care for them. If they tried to bow to him, he would grab them, embrace them, he would kiss them. And he'd say, now tell me your little problem. And they would say, oh, too bad you're not going to be able to get justice for that. If I was king, you would. And he wins the hearts of the people. He's able to win them over. Now, he's established his own political party, and he's been a very successful campaigner because lots of people come over to him. So he not only was very handsome, but he was charming. And charming people, again, can use that positively, or they can use it to simply get people to give them what they want. And Absalom is really not interested in the people or justice for them. He's interested in himself, and he wants to have everyone like him, and he wants them to promote him as the next king. So what was going on with David? Some of these things you say, well, how would David know? This is one of those things had to be right out there in public. No reason why David wouldn't have known. My son is in the city gate wooing people and drawing them to himself. He's going, you know, having the horses and chariots and the 50 guys. That was what kings did. So he's already looking kingly, even though everyone knew he wasn't king yet. But they can see him now. Oh, yeah, he looks kingly. He's like presidential. He looks kingly. And maybe he would make a really good king. So David has to know that this is going on. Finally, Absalom goes to a certain place, Hebron, where David had been originally crowned king, and he says to all of his followers, okay, time to crown me king. And then he makes plans to go and storm Jerusalem, kill his father, and take over the kingdom. David, through his reconnaissance, finds out about Absalom's plan, so he leaves Jerusalem barefoot, going toward the Kidron Valley over to the Mount of Olives. And as he's moving along, the people are greeting him. Some are cursing him, some are praising him, but there's a mixed message that's going on with the people. David eventually gets across the Jordan River, and the forces of David are organized, the forces of Absalom are organized, and they begin to clash. Now, David, this was one of the things, one of the advantages that Absalom had is that he was able to convince one of David's best advisors to join him. But a second advisor was able to spoil the influence of the first advisor. Both of them came to Absalom and said, we want to support you. But the second one was really a ruse. And so Absalom thinks, I should attack him right now. That's what Ahithophel had recommended. Attack him right now while he's disorganized. I can kill him and save the people and bring them all back. Hushai, the second advisor, said, no, you don't want to do that. What you want to do is you want to organize your whole group of people, and then you want to lead them as their leader, you know, their great general. And then you can, right now, if you won't find David with the rest of the troops. They'll have him hidden away somewhere. But you need to just go surround the whole thing so there's no way to hide him. And that appeals to the pride of Absalom, and so that's what he does. But as the two sides clash, David has already strategically placed his people. When the two sides clash, Absalom is racing along on his mule, a kingly animal. And as he races along, he goes under a tree, and either his head or his hair get caught in the branches. The mule goes out from under him and goes on. Joab comes along and kills him. Now, David had said before the battle ever began, when you finally get to Absalom, don't do him any harm. I want him well. I want him brought back. And his people are like, he's trying to kill you, and you want to bring him. What is this? You know, they have a hard time understanding it. So when they finally have to tell David, Absalom is dead. He is devastated. He was hoping so much to be able to reconcile with him in some way. So in his uncontrollable weeping, you hear him say this. He said, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. What's going through his mind? Was it all those 5 years of missed opportunities to really relate reciprocally with his son? Was it his own bad history that just, if I hadn't done that, then that and that wouldn't have happened? What's going on in David's mind? He's just distraught. Finally, they actually have to say to David, if you don't come around and praise the troops for winning the battle for you, they're all going to leave you. And so David makes an appearance of, well, thank you for what you've done for me. But he really is in agony over the loss of his son. Fathers, we have a tremendous privilege when we have children. But it's so easy for us to give our best focus somewhere else. We are, after all, breadwinners and, you know, strong. We move into our communities with energy. So it's so easy for us to leave the child rearing to someone else. David is exhibit one to say that doesn't work well. Some women are able to do that very well, but they shouldn't be required. Shouldn't be asked to do that alone. It's a family thing. And at this point, David is probably feeling like, I have blown it so badly in that I have lost my children. I now have lost Amnon. Now I've lost Absalom. And there's another boy coming along that's going to pull some of the same stunts. And it says, even after all this happened, David never once went to Adonijah, who was trying to become king before his time. He never once went to Adonijah and said, why are you doing what you're doing? He never confronted him. And David has got to be thinking, I have really failed in my ability to relate to my children in a way that's meaningful. In Luke 15, we had one son who said to his father, I never want to be like you. I want to leave home as soon as possible. I wish you were dead. Give me my inheritance now, and I'm going to go make something out of myself. He goes to the far country and loses it all. Comes to his senses and says, I was so stupid. My father even has servants at home that are eating well. I'm here competing with pigs for bitter carob pods. I'll go home. And he goes home to a hero's welcome. He goes home to be reinstalled as the son. The one who was dead is alive again. We had the older brother who, when he realized there was a party for the younger boy and that the fatted calf had been killed and the whole community was invited, he said, not me, I'm not going. And so we find out from him that he's been living as a servant all those years. He looked the part. Everyone would have thought he was doing well. Everyone thought he was an official family member, but he had no relationship with his father. He considered himself to be slaving for his father, and that his father never did anything for him. The father in Luke 15 is God. The picture is of God. God never has to apologize for anything. The story in 2 Samuel that we've gone over this morning is about a real family. And in real families, confession is appropriate. And we need to figure out, just what role did I play? So often we wait for the other person to confess first. Especially if you're the father, you need to own, without judging your child for what they've done. There's plenty to judge them for. God can take care of that. But admit what you have done. This will open the door for some potential intimacy that could not be there. Absalom never comes home. And you don't want that. Father, by your grace, help us. You've called us into such a marvelous life of trusting and obeying you. And I pray that you would, through your word, give us the sensitivity to know how best to do that. Our children are a gift from you. Our grandchildren are a gift from you. And you give us the opportunity to leave them a legacy that will count forever. Or you give us the opportunity to blow it. May, by your grace, we dedicate ourselves again to studying and thinking and preparing ourselves to live well with our children. Sometimes we need the guidance of other people to show us where we are, where we're not making it with our children. So I pray that my brothers and sisters here today would take the courage to seek out the counsel of others and say, what do you see in my life? What do you see with my children? Give me some feedback in order that we might improve and grow and be more God-honoring. This we pray in the name of Jesus. Amen.